Welcome to our Goals to Podcasts, where we take you behind the scenes with authors of many different writing styles. I'm Lucinda Hawksley, and today we're looking at the art of novel writing. I hope you enjoy this episode. If you want to find out more, go to www.goldster.co.uk and don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Goals to Conversations. I'm absolutely thrilled on this inside story to be joined by Amanda Craig, who I have met before only on Zoom. So for me, this is really exciting to meet you face to face.
Me too.
I feel like I've known you for years because of social media and your wonderful books, but it's actually the first time I've met you in person. So welcome.
No, it's lovely to meet you too, Lucinda. You had a rather disastrous Zoom interview, I seem to remember, because I was in Italy.
Yeah, you were in Italy with very poor Wi-Fi. Yeah. It was actually quite hilarious, the Zoom interview we did before. So you're here today to talk mostly, but not exclusively, about your latest book. Do you want to show everybody the book?
It's, that's the cover, which those of you who know Botticelli's Primavera will no doubt recognise. somewhat tweaked because my three graces have gone a rather Trumpian shade of orange. And they've got, two of them have got glasses on and one's wearing a Fitbit. So this is a modern story, in other words.
So tell us about the three graces. What was the premise behind it? Tell us who the characters are.
Well, the three graces are three octogenarian ladies, one German, one English and one American, Marta, Diana and Ruth, who are very, very different characters, but they've become friends partly because they all live around this fictional Tuscan hill town called Sant'Onno. And I began thinking about this novel, it must have been about 20 years ago, because in fact, all my novels are interconnected. You can read them all separately, but it's more fun if you read them all. And my very first novel called Foreign Bodies was also set 33 years ago in this fictional place. And I thought it would be interesting to revisit the place and some of the characters 30 years on. And then as my own mother, because I grew up in Italy and my parents lived for 50 years in a little cottage in a Tuscan hill town, I thought it would be interesting to write about older people. And my mother, who's now 96 and still with us, lived there, you know, until she was 90 and had to be airlifted out.
Gosh.
She really loved it. And I just became more and more interested in all these elderly people who were, you know, rocking on and how different they were from the way that I kept seeing older people being depicted in film and fiction. Mm-hmm. And I got actually quite angry about this because although, as we all know, as you get older, bits of you tend to stop working quite so well and it's a bit harder to get up out of bed and there are various physical problems. You know, it's not the case that every single person over 70 is demented and terribly frail and housebound and so on. And the people that I could see were, like my three heroines, you know, just as they were. I mean, I can read a little bit to give you a flavour.
Please do. I'd love you to read us a bit.
But, you know, this is the kind of older people I think does exist and who I love. So this is the first chapter. The three women who met for coffee in Via Nazionale every Saturday morning were united by age, exile, the love of dogs and their disinclination to discuss their infirmities. Enough of the organ grinding, Marta declared, if anyone complained of arthritic joints, failing eyesight, dizziness or debility. Between them, they had four breasts, five eyes and three hip replacements. These were the price of living long lives, as were one divorce, one widowhood and one husband with dementia. Age had not diminished them. Quite the opposite. They had become more concentrated versions of themselves, just as a pot of soup does the longer it is simmered. One must not look back, was Ruth's philosophy. To look back is to regret what can't be changed. Dogs are happy because they live in the present, and so must we, agreed Diana. Eviva, said Marta. Let us live and love, for tomorrow we die. So that's
Wonderful introduction to your characters. Tell us a little bit more about each of those fabulous women who I really fell in love with in this book.
Thank you. Well, they are very different. Mm-hmm. Ruth is a retired American psychotherapist who's actually worked most of her life in England in the NHS. And she's been one of those people who I call the sort of North London Jewish aristocracy. You know, it's all terribly, you know, everybody knows everybody. They're all, you know, fairly well off. They're incredibly liberal and cultured and a bit smug quite often. Diana, is completely different. She's a 1956 Deb of the Year. She's an English aristocrat. She's very frail. She's surviving an absolutely appalling marriage to her husband, Lord Evenlode, who's an old-fashioned colonialist. He's a former farmer in what's now called Zimbabwe and ex-Tory MP. And she's had a rotten life, four children, last of whom was the long-awaited son and heir, who's not shown any sign of having children himself. So she feels, if you are a member of that class and that generation, as some may know, if you don't have a male heir and your male heir doesn't have a male heir, you feel that your whole life is wasted. Which is an extraordinary idea, but there you go. And Marta the Third is the artist. She's a concert pianist who was quite famous in her youth, and then sort of, you know, had one child and was widowed. And these three, and she's actually Diana's sister-in-law, completely different. So there's quite a lot of friction. So this is about female friendship. But it's also about the kind of scratchy bits of female friendship when people are kind of dying to tell each other what they think of each other and don't, but occasionally do explode. And over the 2 weeks in which the novel is set, these three women have various challenges because Ruth, the American lady, her favorite grandson is getting married to the very beautiful Tanya, who looks a bit like Botticelli's Venus and who's an influencer. And the three old ladies can see that if this marriage goes ahead, it will be an utter disaster for everybody. So they kind of somehow have to stop this. And there's also a plot involving illegal immigrants, which Marta's mixed-race grandson is involved in because he finds someone hiding on the hillside and thinks that he's a wedding guest and sort of sucks him into the whole story. But there's a very kind of nasty plot involving a murder that, you know, there are all sorts of people who need to be helped. So a lot happens in this book.
It does. It's a great read.
Thank you.
But it's very funny. I mean, I want to talk to you about your humour as well, but it's not just humorous. I mean, as you mentioned the migrant crisis. Yeah. Talk about dementia. There's some really serious aspects here. And that's, I think, what makes it such a great novel is you can feel with the characters, they're real life situations. So but let's talk a little bit about the fact that it is very funny. I mean, your writing in general is very funny. Is that just natural? Do you have to work at that?
No, I mean, it is natural. And I do see life as being this great mixture, this interleaving of comedy and tragedy and the serious and the farcical. If you write literary fiction, you know, as I do, the awful thing is that you are very much marked down if you have any jokes. You know, you're supposed to be deadly serious all the way through. And I find that very frustrating. And because I know that actual readers love it, you know, and they feel it's more truthful as a portrait.
Definitely. As you say, it's real life. It's the funny things that sometimes even in the saddest moments, there are funny things that happen.
Yes, yes. No, I mean, I still remember with enormous gratitude when my father dropped dead and, you know, sitting with my mother and sister, and we watched the silliest film, comedy film ever. I think it was called Blades of Glory, about two ice skating rivals. And we were roaring with laughter and sobbing our hearts out. And that, to me, is kind of life. You know, you know, as your illustrious great-grandfather also knew, you know, it is this great mixture.
Yeah.
So it is problematic. And I quite often find that, you know, critics don't really know what to make of me because of this thing that, you know, literary fiction should be, well, I don't think it's serious. They think it should be solemn, which is a different thing altogether.
Yeah, which is absolutely not, as you say, what readers want.
Yes. And, you know, every, it seems to me, every great artist does this mixture. Mm-hmm. You know, Mozart is full of lifeless life and vitality and comedy and also deep sorrow, you know, and that is
life.
That's life.
So tell us about Tanya, because I found her such a fascinating character. Give us her background, because she's appeared before.
She has appeared before in another novel set in Tuscany. I've written three novels set in Tuscany, Foreign Bodies and Love and Idleness, where Tanya first appears as a small child, which is a kind of reworking of A Midsummer Night's Dream. She's now grown up. She's 25. She's incredibly beautiful, and she's an influencer. And when I first began to write this character, I loathed her. I thought she was I thought she was so spoiled and so superficial. And there is that thing that very, very beautiful people have, where they are living in a kind of bubble. Everybody wants to please them. People are so amazed, you know. I mean, I'm talking about people who are beautiful, not just pretty. Yeah. And life seems a lot easier for them. And then as I went on writing, I began to think, well, actually, you know, I do know one or two people who are like this, and actually their life is complete hell. Because certainly when they were young women, they couldn't walk down a street without being not just wolf whistled, but, you know, it was horrible for them. Yeah. And they were terrified. They couldn't have a normal job because the men in the office kept hitting on them. And then I heard an absolutely terrible story, which I used for Tanya in the climax of the book, which explains a lot about the way she is so irritating, and not just entitled, but she can't really work out how ordinary people feel or are supposed to live. And that was a real turning point. And, you know, I do love all my characters, especially the awful ones. But I've been very pleased by how touched people have been by Tanya. I mean, one thing that it doesn't spoil the book to know is she's actually autistic, and girls and women with autism seem to take a very, very long time, perhaps even half their lives, to get a diagnosis. Mm-hmm. And people think they're just snotty or weird. You know, if you've ever known someone who people say, well, they're a bit like an alien or a changeling, that person is almost certainly autistic. And they're working tremendously hard to appear to be normal. It's called masking. And Tanya is one of those people. So she's got a kind of double burden. But she too needs to be rescued by the Three Graces from this disaster marriage, which will destroy her.
And when you're thinking about your characters, because as you said, fairly often they do recur in your book, they come back again in subsequent books, do you sit down and plot them out? Do they come to you organically? Do they appear when you're writing? How does it work?
A mixture of all three, really. I mean, they're people who I'm really interested in. So Marta's grandson, Zan, the mixed race boy, he's reappearing in the novel I'm writing now because I'm so interested in him.
He's a great character.
Thank you. Well, you know, he's very, you know, he's flawed, and but, you know, he's a lovely boy. And I became very interested in what it is to be mixed race because, you know, I don't think now I would feel that comfortable writing someone about someone who was black, because I feel that that has to be written about by someone who is black. You know, it's too... But I feel that I have know enough people and have talked and researched and imagined my way into that situation to feel very comfortable writing Zan.
And you yourself came from kind of two parents of two different heritage or cultural backgrounds.
Very different in every way. So I was born in South Africa, and my mother is South African, and again, from very kind of different backgrounds, Russian Jewish on one side, and Scottish colonialist on the other. So that was you know, she is very kind of divided. And then my father, again, is from more Scottish, but again, very split. They were from different social classes, different educational or non-educational backgrounds. And they were, they left South Africa when I was a baby because they were anti-apartheid. Mm-hmm. They were both journalists. And as journalists, they covered this terrible event called the Sharpeville Massacre, which is still very, very famous, where at the beginning of apartheid, the South African white police fired on black unarmed protesters. And it was so horrifying that my mother, who'd always hated the racism, said, we cannot bring a child up in this country. So they left. And it was a big moral and indeed financial choice, because if you were a white person in the 1950s, 1960s, you had an extraordinarily comfortable life with, my father, for instance, got a driving license without ever having taken a test in his life, simply because he was white.
Oh, that's so insane.
It was absolutely insane. So they came to Europe, first to Italy, which my mother always loved, then to London, where they again worked as journalists for a bit, and then back to Italy, where they worked for the UN. Mm-hmm. It's a big uprooting. That and there was a group of people, many of them academics and journalists, who did flee South Africa for that reason.
Yeah,
all very interesting.
So you grew up with two journalists as parents. It's not surprising, really, that you first of all became a journalist yourself and then a novelist. Tell us first of all what it was like, your writing journey yourself. Did you feel you had to write because your parents were writers?
Or? No, not at all. No, I originally wanted to be a doctor.
Oh, did you?
Yes. And then I was no good at maths. So in those days, you had to be really quite good at maths to go to medical school. But then once I started, and I was always an absolutely ardent reader, and then I realised that what I really wanted to do was write. But a bit of that doctorishness, I think, is still in my fiction, because I do think that good fiction is a kind of healing art. And some of the things, the most wonderful reader responses I've had is when people have written to me or told me that, you know, they read a book of mine when they were in hospital or when they were very, very depressed, and it really helped them. And in fact, the best compliment I think I ever had was when someone said, actually, my doctor's furious with me because I was having an operation and I was going under anaesthesia and I wouldn't put your book down and I wasn't going under.
That's fabulous.
So that was nice, yes, the power of a story.
Yes, but it took a long time and I still slightly ride two horses. I still do some bits of journalism. So, for instance, this week we've both written pieces for the National Press about Wilkie Collins.
Yeah, Wilkie Collins bicentenary this week.
Bicentenary.
You've done one on Wilkie Collins and Charles Dickens.
Yes, that's right.
You've done one on Wilkie's younger brother, who was an artist.
Yes, also interesting.
Yeah.
And he's one of the people who I discovered after reading English at Cambridge, and nearly losing the will to live, certainly losing the will to read, because, you know, it was so grinding, the approach that they had.
Frustrating.
Very frustrating. But thank God, the people I didn't touch were the great Victorian novelists. So I emerged sort of exhausted from exams and picked up two books. One was Wilkie Collins's fabulous thriller, The Woman in White, and the other was Charles Dickens's Our Mutual Friend.
Oh, wow.
So these two
books.
Wonderful books that both are great literary fiction and are completely compelling and you can't put them down. And I thought, this is what I want to write. You know, you can combine these two things.
Yeah.
And you can use stuff, contemporary stuff that you find out as a journalist. So I do lots and lots of research. One of my other huge bugbears is that for most of my life, thanks to people like Hilary Mantel, literary fiction is supposed to be historical. And if you write contemporary fiction, it's somehow dismissed as journalistic. It really isn't. It really
not at all. That seems crazy.
Yeah. But, you know, I know what I'm talking about. Yeah. And it's, you know, it has been an absolutely titanic struggle, which is ongoing.
Well, let's talk a bit about location. You mentioned you've written three novels set in Tuscany, but you've written nine novels so far. You're writing your 10th, is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah. So how important is location to you? Do you think about the location before you start writing the novel?
Yes, it's huge. I mean, it people now say it's like another character in the book. The one I'm writing now is set in a very grungy bit of North London, just up the road from where I live. And that is as important as the characters, because I think it sets, it's like the key in a piece of music, you know, it sets the tone, it sets the mood. So this novel, The Three Graces, set in Tuscany, is full of the joy of spring and the incredible incandescent beauty of Tuscany. It's also about, of course, the underbelly of Tuscany that people don't usually know about or describe. And it was an absolute pleasure to write. I actually wrote it in the height of the pandemic, when everybody was saying, oh, we've all got to write dystopian novels. But I thought, no, because there was no vaccine when I was writing this, and we didn't know how long it was going to last. People were very fearful. But we also had that incredible spring. And I thought, I need to write about the beauty of spring and the time that I know will return when people can get married again and they can have parties. So I was sort of casting my mind into the future. And then rather miraculously, by the time it came out, you know, all these things had come to pass. So people thought, oh, this is really up to them. But it was a big leap of imagination.
Yeah. And must have been wonderful escapism as well.
Yes.
To imagine yourself back in Tuscany. You weren't in Tuscany.
No, we were in Devon. Yeah. And just seeing nobody except our dog. And so it was a very kind of magical time, and I think that did help the feeling of, you know, renaissance and joy and so on. And I've always been very obsessed by Botticelli's wonderful paintings of the birth of Venus and the Primavera. I've actually got the Primavera as my screensaver on my laptop. And it was looking at that every day. And I just thought, but why do the three graces have to be young, beautiful nymphs? Why can't they be old? Because very often in fairy tales and myths, the three figures, you get these three figures again and again and again in all the kind of early myths. So the Vikings had the Norns, these three ancient crones who knew the future. And the Greeks had the Fates, you know, the three Fates. And they were always old women. So I thought, well, why not make them old? So that it kind of grew out of
Fantastic.
That.
Fantastic. Yeah. And so you talked about the underbelly. Let's talk about the more stark realities, because we think about Italy here, and think, oh, yes, Tuscan vineyards, how wonderful. But tell us, you've lived in Italy for a long time. What is that underbelly that comes across in your book?
Well, it's very much happening at the moment. You know, if you read the papers, you'll know that Italy now has a very right-wing Prime Minister, Giorgia Meloni, who is trying to really stop the boats. And Italy is on the front line of this crisis where I think it's now 200,000 or maybe even 250,000 people are coming over from North Africa, absolutely desperate, and arriving in Italy because it's the point of it's the closest point to North Africa. And it's presented Italians with, you know, some really awful choices, because Italy has, and I have a lot of comic fun with this attitude where even somebody who's from another parish, i.e., you know, that they've got different church bells in the village next door, is seen as an alien, and you're allowed to hate them and despise them and not talk to them. And Italy suddenly confronted with, you know, up to 250,000 of people arriving from North Africa, what do you do? Well, some of them have responded as, with incredible humanity and generosity and helpfulness. And I'm afraid a lot more of them have reacted with absolute fear and loathing. And you can, you can literally just drive along a road in Italy and see these black prostitutes soliciting drivers, particularly lorries. There are beggars in every tourist place. You know, it's just horrific, the whole thing. And where you get these acute moral and humanitarian dilemmas, that's always a very interesting place to explore in fiction. So part of my purpose in writing this book was not only to write about a lovely story and three delightful elderly women, it was also to explore the kind of Tuscany that you don't see in Merchant Ivory films. Mm-hmm. And in fact, another inspiration for The Three Graces is the very famous novel and film by Ian Forster, A Room with a View. And that novel is also about, some young people falling in love with the wrong people.
Yeah.
And their elderly relations. And I thought how interesting it would be to kind of flip that and to make the elderly women at the centre of the story,
yeah,
and the younger ones and their romantic entanglements kind of somewhat secondary. Yeah. So that too.
And when you look at your characters, I mean, you've got someone who, as you say, you get the desperation across, that the empathy that we have for this migrant who is there not knowing what's going to happen, living in fear of his life.
Yeah.
And being mistaken as a wedding guest, really kind of like she wedding.
Yes.
And just kind of going with the flow. Tell us about how that happened. There's wonderful humour and also fear in that, because
yes,
I kept thinking, he's going to be found out.
Well, because I've got this mixed race character hero, Zan, he is walking between those two worlds, the worlds of the middle class, wealthy white people, and his growing sympathy and anger on behalf of people who are like his Nigerian father, who he finds in The Lie of the Land. And I just thought how interesting it would be to have that set up. And he finds this young man who's sort of his own age called Blessing, who's hiding out on the hillside, and he very deliberately introduces him. He doesn't ask him too many questions. Mm-hmm. As a guest that he's found lost on the hillside, he's lost his luggage, all these lies, and he's just accepted.
Mm.
And he's absolutely charming and really well, and he too changes things for, yes, these characters.
He absolutely does.
Time.
And I think about, with the character, the ex-Zimbabwean, or what he would have called, yeah, Rhodesia,
yeah,
suddenly needing the assistance of Blessing. And the,
yes,
name Blessing in itself, he is a blessing.
He is a blessing, but it is, yeah, a Zimbabwean, yes, quite a common, yeah, name, Zimbabwe. Yes, Lord Evenload, yeah, the appalling old man with dementia. Yes, he's in a wheelchair now, and Blessing does help him. And and there is a great secret in the Evenload marriage that is yeah, uncovered.
Oh, I don't want to give away too much of it, but it is a fabulous book. Okay, so this is the ninth of your novels. Tell us how it began with the first novel, what it's been like. I know you had a problem with your third novel. Give us an idea, yes, of your career from when you started writing novels.
Well, it was a very kind of rocky career, because when I began as a journalist, I didn't particularly want to be a journalist, but I could see that was, the way that I could earn some kind of living and in fact, in those days, get a mortgage. And I was very lucky because I won a couple of prizes as a young journalist. Mm-hmm. But I didn't really, I wasn't one of these kind of big name columnists. And a lot of noses, I think, were put out of joint when I won these prizes, because when my first novel, Foreign Bodies, was published, I was very much, I think, seen as a tall poppy to take, mm-hmm, down, and I had no kind of allies. I mean, journalism is both wonderful and full of, you know, really interesting, brave, witty, kind people, and absolutely a piranha pool. And, you know, I was so naive. I didn't kind of realise the piranha pool bit. Mm-hmm. And I had a very, very horrible reception for this book. You know, absolutely savage. And, you know, I was just this person who'd written a book. But, you know, I had whole pages in the Sunday Times about how dreadful I was, how dreadful this book was. You know, I didn't know any of these people. So that was very difficult. And I was also very shocked by how corrupt the literary world was. And, you know, it's changed a lot in 30 years, but it was, newspapers were very much more powerful then, and they had a lot more coverage of books, sadly, which sadly they don't now. So when I came to write my third novel, called A Vicious Circle, I thought, well, I'm actually going to satirise this world because I'm so appalled by it.
Well, chose the name of Vicious Circle.
A Vicious Circle. Well, it was very vicious. And, you know, some of the things that I'd heard literary editors say, you know, were so ludicrous. And people were doing what I described in the novel as the fear or favours market. You know, when you write a review, are you going to make yourself feared in this world by savaging a book? Always good for the career of a certain kind of journalist. Yes. Or are you going to do them a favour, in which case they're going to have to be nice to you forever and ever after? And people were, you know, absolutely astounded by this book. And unfortunately, what I'd forgotten was that I had at Cambridge this rather awful boyfriend who had become a leading critic. So when the proofs of this novel, A Vicious Circle, was circulating before it was actually in a proper book in the bookshop, he popped up and wrote this letter that in retrospect, you know, was hilarious, but they didn't, claiming to be the villain of this book, claiming to be this ghastly critic who the heroine is living with and so on. And I'd had a very difficult relationship with Hamish Hamilton, imprint of Penguin, and the woman who was then running it. And she was, she hated my agent. You know, it really was all these kind of internet. Anyway, she cancelled the book. And at that point, the book, of course, exploded. It became a news story. So she stopped the book, and five other publishers, because of all the publicity, said, we want it instead. So that was a rather wonderful thing. So, you know, I got paid twice because, you know, this woman had said this book's unpublishable, but five other people wanted it, and I got paid about three times more money.
Excellent.
So I was able to move house. it was
well,
one of those little mad stories. All
end.
Thanks to the awful ex-boyfriend who still hates me and, you know, still is very mad. But so many other people hate him that it kind of cancelled it out. So it's a sort of mad world that you have to navigate. And most people who read books and love books know nothing of this world, which is probably just as well, because it's a bit like, you know, Hollywood,
only
with much
you
less money.
You don't want to know exactly what's going on.
But it, you know, it is one of the things that you have to be, I think, informed about and braced for.
Yeah.
You know, this is the kind of fiction. This is not the kind of, you know, chick lit type fiction.
Yeah.
You know, this is the sort of more literary end of it. And it's very, very brutal.
But isn't it interesting? Because you mentioned the word chick lit. Do you think that because you're a female writer, people just assume that you need to be pigeonholed in a certain way? Do you think there's still a prejudice?
I think there is a lot of prejudice. I don't think anybody would dare to do that to me. But it you know, it was certainly worse 30 years ago that all women writers were assumed to be writing this. And I think one of the reasons why historical fiction became something for women to write was that you obviously were, you know, had a bit more kind of academic input if you did that. But yeah, I mean, it is a long... I mean, now the people who have prejudice against them, of course, are young men. And I'm quite anxious about that, because, you know, all prejudice is bad.
Well, exactly, yes. And surely it should just be that a book
is good or
stands
not.
Alone, yeah, and, yeah, and regardless of who the author is. I mean, we've had recent success by people like Bonnie Garmus, had her first novel published in her 60s. Do you think that there is more interest in older writers now? Do you think that it stopped being such a prejudice against, because there was a time when, you know, every prize was for, you know,
young
novelists under 35 or whatever. Do you think that's changing or not?
I hope so. I mean, there have always been older writers who people have discovered, you know, people like Penelope Fitzgerald, who won the Booker.
Mary Wesley,
famously. You know, there have always been outliers. Mm-hmm. But I think that there is a bit of a sea change now happening with older people in general, that partly, I'm afraid, economic, because it's older people who've got the money and indeed the power, you know, and so it's the young who are now disadvantaged. I mean, you know, there's both a good side and a bad side to this. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, anything that's making people, you know, a group of people who've been totally dismissed and overlooked more visible and perhaps more seen as fellow human beings, mm-hmm, is can only be good.
Yeah.
And there's some wonderful older writers who have come forward.
I mean, yes. How much do you think the publishing industry, you said your first novel came out 33 years ago. Mm-hmm. Have you seen a big change in publishing as an industry in those 33 years?
Yeah, I have. I mean, again, some of it very good. It's definitely become much more professional and professionalised. So my novels are now not just edited by one woman with possibly a degree or possibly not, but it's put through the kind of digestive tract of my publishers by about five or six super bright, meticulous people. There's still the odd spelling mistake that you spot that has to be correct.
There's ever been a book published that doesn't have a spelling mistake.
It doesn't have that. But, you know, I now have the most wonderful team behind me at Abacus who I can trust and who kind of get me and all the rest of it. The slight downside of that is that there are something like five times more books published. I mean, way too many.
Yes.
And every book has to fight really hard to be noticed, you know, whether reviewed, whether it's stocked in bookshops. And also there is the wretched Amazon, which has made the life of both authors, because when you get your nice discounted copy through Amazon, the people who are losing from that are both the publisher and the author.
Yeah.
You know, we are the ones paying for your 20%
or
30% discount.
Yeah.
So that's grim. And it's much tougher for booksellers. And I think that's really worrying, because they are the lifeblood of our industry.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's... And what do you want to talk about? Because I know we talked earlier about the realities of life as an author. What do you think? Because many people listening to this just think that authors have this incredibly glamorous life, and you spend all your time just sitting around airy fairy writing a few words and earning fortune. What are the realities of being a jobbing author?
A jobbing author. Well, even a successful author, which, you know, supposedly I count as. The reality is that as an author, you earn less than the minimum wage. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm talking about something like $12,000 a year once it's all evened out.
Yep.
So you cannot usually survive on writing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously there are people who, there's a minute number of people who are very famous and do sell a lot, probably about maximum 20. Mm-hmm. There are commercial writers who have to churn out, I think, at least a book a year, if not two. And, you know, I have total respect for them, but that's, again, a different world. No, it's very, very boring. You need to have, as Virginia Woolf said, you know, you need to have as boring and repetitive a life as possible in order for your mind to be free.
Yes. And there is the financial aspect.
The financial aspect.
A woman needs money in a room of her own in which to write.
Yeah.
That still applies to men and women.
Yeah.
I remember there was a report from the Society of Authors a few years ago. I think it was, may be misquoting, but I think it was 95% of authors in this country earn less than £7,000 a year from their books.
Yeah, that's so really low.
That's really shocking. So 5% are earning the top earners.
Yeah.
Everybody else is earning less than £7,000
a year. You need to have a job as well. Yeah.
Yeah. Is that something that's changed over your career? Do you think when you first started writing novels, it was easier to make a better living as a writer?
It was, yes, it definitely was. Simply because if you could also do journalism, you could have a life. I mean, I was able to get a mortgage in 1988, you know, for the world's most tiny flat, but, you know, I still was able to do it. Now you wouldn't have a chance.
Yeah.
And journalism has also been cut off at the knees.
Yes.
So there's, the other kinds of careers, like being an academic, they too have become impossible. I mean, it really is very serious, this, because even if you don't read literary fiction or think you like it, you will almost certainly love going to the cinema or watching stuff being streamed on television.
Yeah.
And, you know, actually a lot of that comes from books.
Yeah.
So you will lose masses of things that will bring you joy and pleasure if this goes as a culture.
Yeah. Well, I hope it doesn't, because I think there's plenty of people listening to this who love books. And, so let's talk a little bit about your actual process of writing. So the nuts and bolts of it. When you were writing The Three Graces, what time do you get up? How many hours a day do you work? Do you have a kind of writing limit or hour limit per day? What do you do?
Well, depending on how much my husband's been snoring all night, I'm usually up and working by 9:30. That could slip by an hour, but actually, what I have to do every day is walk my dog. My dog is not just my emotional support animal; he's the thing that gets me out of bed and exercising, and that I think is absolutely vital, because all of us, I think, I mean, not just in crises like lockdown, but most people have great struggles with their mental health. Mm-hmm. And I'm very glad that we now live in an age where people can say that openly.
Yeah.
And if you are doing the kind of work which requires you to look inside yourself and think very hard every day, the chances are that that will also not be great for your mental health. And having an animal that you have to get out and you have to be in nature and you have to, you know, be there for them is completely brilliant. And I'm always appalled that a lot of writers seem to think that the animal they should have in their life is a cat. because this is the very worst thing you could possibly have. I know lots of people love cats. I'm very allergic to them, so I'm not one of them. But what you need in your life, if you possibly can habit, is a dog.
Oh, something I'm totally
extroverted,
yes.
You know, devoted to you. You know, you are God. You know, this is all wonderful for your mental health. So I go out every day and I walk for at least an hour, sometimes two, and then I come back and write.
And are you formulating when you're walking?
I'm thinking.
Thinking about the book and what you're going to write that day?
Yes, I'm thinking about that and some of the ideas and the characters. I mean, this is a process, though, that goes on, you know, even at 3 o'clock in the morning. So, you know, you're always thinking about your characters. And a writer is, I think, a very annoying person to live with, because you're very often quite absent-minded because you're actually thinking about this alternative universe that you're trying to create.
And do your characters become part of everyday life? Do you miss them when you finish writing a book?
Well, I don't miss the ones very often because I can bring them back.
Yes,
you see, that's the thing. And I'm always amazed that more writers don't do this. I mean, it's something that I learned from Trollope in particular, who was the most wonderful Victorian novelist. And he did this and he carried characters on. And you see, you know, sometimes major characters popping up as minor ones in other kinds of novel. And I think it's the most marvellous device. So I don't miss my characters because I can always bring them back.
Yeah.
I tend you know, if there's a romantic story, I tend not to bring those characters back because I think, you know, once they're happily
you
married.
You don't want to stop the happy ever after. I do, and show all the fights and everything.
No, but I have also written about, you know, a marriage in the Lie of the Land where people, you know, their marriage is falling apart. Mm-hmm. It's about a couple who can't afford to divorce. And yes, that was very interesting.
Really
to think
interesting.
About. Yeah.
Yeah.
So they can all come back. And I have also learned, you know, to not kill people off if possible. Mm-hmm. Because that's always a great mistake. People often, you know, I love my villains. You know,
I was told that by an editor recently. Yeah. You can't bring them back if you kill them off, you know.
Yeah.
Can't.
Yeah, so you can have them leave the country or, yeah. you know, disappear mysteriously, but don't kill them. Yeah.
Yeah. So you said you're working on something at the moment.
Yeah.
Are you able to tell us a little bit about it or not?
Yeah. Well, it's all set on one day, which I haven't done before.
Oh, interesting.
And it's a day kind of like now. It's in the middle of the worst month of the year, mm-hmm. January, just after Christmas. Mm-hmm. Everybody's feeling miserable and poor and so on. And it's set in a street of mostly pretty shabby shops. And one in particular is going to come under assault. From there's a big crime element, so it's basically a siege novel.
Right, interesting.
One of my favourite films is something by a filmmaker called John Carpenter, called Assault on Precinct 13, where this group of people are all being assailed by gunmen, and I've always thought this would be such an interesting thing to write about here.
Yeah.
Because although we don't have guns, or so many guns, what we do have a lot of are knives. Mm-hmm. And there are gangs. And I discovered that at the end of my road is one of the many roads that the police refer to as Murder Mile. So there have been quite a lot of really horrific knife crime.
And so if you've got them all locked in, it's a bit like a kind of 21st century version of a country house locked room mystery.
Yes. Well, that's the thing that, you know, I'm always very interested on the effect of, I think Wilkie Collins said that's what he was doing, the effect of circumstances upon character.
Yeah.
And, you know, how people would respond, you know, people who mostly know each other as neighbours or colleagues or friends, in that kind of situation where, you know, you could make yourself a lot safer, mm-hmm. make all the nastiness go away by doing one thing, or you could do the morally right thing and not.
So do you plot your novels before you start writing? Do you let the novel grow?
It grows.
Yeah.
I mean, I always know how it's got to end.
Right.
I know how it's got to begin, okay. and I know how it's got to, but it's all the steps in between.
And do you reach
hard.
A point that you know is the end, or do you have
yes.
to kind of be, that's good, you don't have to kind of be dragged kicking and screaming to a word count or anything?
No. I mean, I know that roughly the it will be 300 pages. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a kind of beat. And one of the things I learned when I was really learning how to plot a book is to try and keep each chapter to a certain length. So if you look at particularly my later books, mm-hmm. each chapter will be about 8 pages long.
Oh, interesting.
Because I think that's about, well, it's about the length that you can kind of read before you go to sleep.
Yes. So. Do you have any other great tips? We've got a lot of aspiring writers on Gotham.
Oh,
do you have
goodness.
Any other tips for,
well, just don't do it. If you have to do it. I mean, I think that there are some. I used to be very against creative writing courses mm-hmm. for a number of reasons, but I think there are some really wonderful teachers who can teach you how to do it better, mm-hmm. quicker. I mean, mostly I think you need to just read. You need to read every day
read
of your life.
Read.
Yeah.
Yeah. And talking of reading, do you have trusted readers of your manuscripts before they go to the publisher? Do you have friends or family members or whoever?
Yes. Well, my husband is one of my first readers. And I had my very best friend, a writer called Kate Saunders, who very sadly died last year. And she and I were both huge fans of Charles Dickens. Mm-hmm. So we'd talk to each other a lot about that, and we'd show each other mm-hmm. manuscripts. And we wouldn't kind of go into what we thought in great details, but sometimes just saying, I don't think you should kill that character off, or, mm-hmm. you know, that was very helpful and wonderful. Yeah. And I miss her terribly.
Yeah, I'm sure.
But most of my friends are writers. So, you know, we're all terribly much there mm-hmm. for each other, mostly women writers, I should say. But not everybody wants that. Mm-hmm. I mean, my view is it's much better to get as many people to read something in manuscript as possible, because they will see something that
yes.
you've been avoiding seeing,
yeah.
And they need to point it out. I will only read other people's manuscripts if they are sort of professional writers, because too many people just want you to read it and say it's wonderful.
Yes, and they don't really want
they don't
genuine
really want
criticism.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And how do you take it when your editors, you've sent in and you've had your readers go through it, you send it and you've got this wonderful team that you've mentioned, which,
yeah.
which is so great to hear, because most yeah. authors say, I don't get edited enough anymore. There's just not enough editors.
I know.
How do you feel when you get that criticism? I find I have to read it and get cross and then go back and go, they're absolutely right. Do you do the same instead of...
Well, I used to. I've got this wonderful man called Richard Bezick, and I've now had him for 23 years. And in the beginning, we were both a bit kind of nervous, and I didn't realise that he had a wonderful sense of humour as well as a very good eye. And now I know that when he tells me this is boring, and you can, but yeah, I mean, there's a terrible tendency all writers have that you let a sort of descriptive passage or a character run away with you, mm-hmm. and you need someone like Richard Bezick to tell you, no, this has got to be cut. You know, it's not
and
working.
It's hard, isn't it? Because you think that's a great bit.
That's
why
a
did
great
they like
risk. It? Yeah, but kill your darlings.
That's a great tip for us.
So that's a great tip.
Kill your darlings and keep your chapters.
If someone says this bit is boring, you must listen.
Yeah.
And think how to make it more interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But he only comes along, you know, really much later. Mm-hmm. But now, you have to, you know, I rewrite my books literally 100 times before he gets to see them.
Gosh, that's interesting. And so you go through draft after draft after draft.
Draft after draft. Fantastic. After draft. And it's just this agonizing thing of having the stamina to do that. And then when the publisher gets hold of it, you are still rewriting your book kind of up to the last moment, up to the point it becomes, you know, that. You know, because sometimes they're just sort of infelicities, sometimes there are factual errors, mm-hmm. but sometimes at the very last moment you get a great wave of inspiration. So, for instance, also in this novel, there is a Russian oligarch who
is living
in the palazzo at the top of this hill town, and he's in hiding from Putin. And Putin, as we all know now, has been knocking off his opponents via poison and other means. And this oligarch, Ivanov, is one of the people who's living in absolute terror that this is going to happen to him, and he is not wrong. And I kept thinking, well, I've got, you know, obviously we all know about Novichok, the poison that the Skripals only had to touch and to go into convulsions, and it's killed other people too. We all know about Berezovsky, who probably was hung by an assassin. But what other methods could you use to kill someone remotely? And when I was finishing the proofs, the war with Ukraine started. Yeah. And I thought, I know, what about a drone? And when I wrote that bit, that was right up to the last minute.
Yeah.
People barely knew what drones looked like, military drones. Of course, now we all know, sadly. And of course, they now have been used to target people for assassination. Mm. But you know, that was really fun to be able to
come
to
up
do
with
that.
Different ideas.
Yeah.
So tell us, we talked a little bit about mental health earlier. What do you do in the dark times? How do you get through that if you're at an impasse in your writing, or if you just aren't feeling the creativity? What's your method?
Well, you can't use it as an excuse not to write. I can't remember who it was who says, you know, the muse doesn't come calling unless you're sitting there at your desk. Yes. And you just have to sit. In fact, one of my other tips is get a really good chair with a cushion, because you will get a very sore bottom as a result, and a large one too, as a result of being a writer. You know, I've had days where I've just sat there, you know, trying, and then at the very last hour, which is normally between 5 and 6, it will suddenly come in a great rush, and that's great. But there are also days where you literally can only write, you know, barely 100 words. And then there are other days where it will just flow and you can write 5,000. So it's very unpredictable. And the only thing that being older and more experienced teaches you is not to despair, and that this is just part of the process. And, you know, if you don't go through this agony, it will probably not be any good.
Thank you. That's fantastic. Real words of wisdom there.
No.
I could talk to you for hours about this. And I can't wait till the next book comes out so you can come back onto Goldster again. Thank you so much for coming today. And for anybody who hasn't yet read The Three Graces, I thoroughly recommend it if you want to go back and read Amanda's earlier novels. There are 8 earlier ones.
Oh, and in 2 years' time, but we don't know that for sure, but I had a very exciting auction for the TV rights from 3 different companies.
Fingers crossed.
From the producer of Downton Abbey in one, and the BBC drama department in another, and the person who won it, who's this woman called Alison Owen, who made Ghosts, Harlots, Brick Lane, Jane Eyre, loads and loads of things. She's absolutely wonderful, and she won it. So we are in development.
Fantastic. So, well, you'll have to come back and talk to us about that, what it's like seeing your work become a TV series. I really, really hope it does. It's a beautiful book. It's funny, but it also has some really great kind of lessons in there. So that makes it sound really didactic. I mean, just, you know, it really made me think about the realities of life in a Tuscan hill town as well. So thank you so much, Amanda. It's been wonderful having you on here today. And please come back again to Goldster. And we've got a comment here saying, excellent. Thank you so much, Amanda. I'll just tell you very quickly what's coming up. So tomorrow I'm interviewing Rachel Trethaway, a great author. She's written a new book called Mothers of the Mind, which is about the mothers of Virginia Woolf, Agatha Christie and Sylvia Plath. Really fascinating. And of course, do check in if you're on Facebook with the new Goldster Conversations Facebook page, where you can tell us what you've enjoyed, what you'd like to see coming up. And do not forget that this month's book of the month is Pride and Prejudice, requested by Goldster members. Pride and Prejudice by Jane Austen. If you haven't read it, start reading it. If you've read it before, reread it and come along, whether you've read it or not, in order to chat about it. And next month, February's book of the month will be Cuckoo in the Nest by Fran Hill, a brand new novel. In fact, I'm interviewing the novelist on the 1st of February. Couldn't put it down. Wonderful book. So I read it in about 2 days and absolutely loved it. So do come back and join us for all the rest of our Goldster Conversations. And Amanda, thank you again. It's just been a real joy to have you here today.
Thank you so much, Lucinda.
Got a comment here from someone who says, I'm buying the book right now.
Wonderful.
That's great.
Thank you, Lucinda.
Thank you for listening to this Goldster podcast, where we aim to bring you great interviews to expand your world and to keep you curious. Please look us up at www.goldster.co.uk. That's Goldster spelt G-O-L-D-S-T-E-R. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast.